Jesus seemed to have this idea that by touching the unclean person, he could actually make them clean. But other people thought, well, you can't touch that person because they make you unclean. So Jesus reversed the vector, the flow of cleanness and uncleanness.
This is the Street Psalms, Word from Below, first podcast. We're trying out a new format with our weekly email, and this week we're having a conversation with Jeff Johnson from Mile High Ministries. We hope you enjoy this new way of experiencing the lectionary, and if you do, please leave us a comment down in the bottom. And now, here's our podcast.
My name is Stephanie Dunlap, and I'm part of the Street Psalms team. I'm here with Jeff Johnson.
Hi, Steffi.
Hey. Jeff is executive director of Mile High Ministries in Denver, Colorado, and a longtime member of the Street Psalms community. Mile High Ministries anchors one of the hubs that comprise the urban training collaborative that Street Psalms is a part of. So Jeff's thoughts about working and living among the poor have informed much of Street Psalms' own work and writings, and we're really excited to talk with him today. Mile High Ministries' Brian Rosbert is also pitching in to help record this podcast.
Hey, everybody.
Thanks, Brian.
Yeah. So this week's lectionary gospel passage is drawn from Mark chapter 7, which I'll read here. Now, when the Pharisees and some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem gathered around him, they noticed that some of his disciples were eating with defiled hands, that is, without washing them. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they thoroughly wash their hands, thus observing the tradition of the elders. And they do not eat anything from the market unless they wash it. And there are also many other traditions that they observe, the washing of cups, pots, and bronze kettles. So the Pharisees and the scribes asked him, "Why do your disciples not live according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with defiled hands?" He said to them, "Isaiah prophesied rightly about you hypocrites. As it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching human precepts as doctrines.' You abandon the commandment of God and hold to human tradition." Then he called the crowd again and said to them, "Listen to me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going in can defile, but the things that come out are what defile. For it is from within, from the human heart, that evil intentions come: fornication, theft, murder, adultery, avarice, wickedness, deceit, licentiousness, envy, slander, pride, folly. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person." The word of the Lord. So we're here with Jeff today because Jeff has worked and lived among people on the margins in Denver for 28 years. Mile High Ministry programs include transitional housing for homeless families and a legal aid clinic for victims of domestic violence. And Jeff, not long ago, you read a book called Unclean: Meditations on Purity, Hospitality, and Mortality by Richard Beck that really caught your imagination. Why did that book impact you so much?
Well, how can you not be impacted or engaged by a book that's all about disgust? And so Richard Beck is a psychologist, a research psychologist. He teaches at a Christian university in the middle part of here in the United States. But his work that he does is around studying what disgusts us, the psychology of disgust, contamination, or, you know, things that gross us out. And so right away, you've just got to be drawn to a book that's about, at least as a guy, you got to be interested in things that gross us out, right? So I just found myself flipping through the book to find the next gross out thing. But, you know, in the middle of it, it was really, he had very interesting observations about the meaning of all of this for Christian spirituality, Christian morality, and then our relationships with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I noticed he has a blog, Experimental Theology, and he wrote there about Christianity and about the Last Supper in particular. This radical openness to the other always seems to get undermined in our churches. Why is that, I mused. After thinking about it, the answer hit me, and it was a simple answer. The same thing that caused the exclusion of people from table fellowship in Jesus' day is the exact same thing that causes the exclusion today. That is, a group of people is considered to be unclean, and these people are just not welcome. The reasons for being declared unclean might have changed, but the underlying dynamic is still the same. And I began to realize the logic of being unclean, a source of, quote, spiritual pollution, was undermining Jesus's radical call to love.
Yes, and I really do like what the way he thinks about the Eucharist or the Lord's table. And it really has invited me even further into a commitment to the openness of the Lord's table, and that it really is about that the whole idea is to move past the idea of the Lord's table as sort of a boundary, a way to mark who's in and who's out, but rather to see it as an all-inclusive celebration. You know, one of the things I wanted to say in thinking about Beck's work, I thought it might be helpful to mention a few of these principles that he talks about. So I'll go quickly on this, but some things about disgust. And what he does, he mentions a lot of the big scientific studies and research that has been done, but the fun part of the book are really the small experiments, the simple little things that he does that you can do, you know, even with a group of friends, you can do these little experiments and see how people respond. I'll tell you about a couple of those in a minute, but he talks about the fact that so much of the way we think about disgust is tied to food. So here Jesus is talking about what comes into the mouth and then what comes out of a person, and that an awful lot of the research around disgust and a lot of the way humans think about clean and unclean and contamination and disgust and all those kind of things become about food. So he calls it core disgust. But then there's also a social disgust, social moral, which is about, you know, certain groups of people that, you know, other groups of people have declared for some reason unclean. And then a third kind is animal reminder disgust. So this is how we don't like to be reminded about gore or deformities or things like that, because they remind us for a moment of our animalness.
Yes.
You know, when we're forced to face our guts, in a sense, you know, the gross stuff inside, then it reminds us that of our embodiedness, really. And so from there, he does an awful lot of thinking about why then incarnation, the whole idea of incarnation is even difficult for us to grasp, because at so many levels, there's so much about the human body that, if we're honest, disgusts us. Mm-hmm. And so hard to think about God, you know, taking on all those disgusting features or experiencing all of that.
So on his on that blog at the very top, Beck quotes Thomas Merton in saying, "Be human in this most inhuman of ages. Guard the image of man, for it is the image of God." And that's what it seems
beautiful
to speak to.
It's great. You know, so a couple of other things on that I wanted to mention. He talks about that a lot of this is about boundaries, and that studying disgust, and how would you like to have a job where you study disgust all day? Where you know, but the disgust is really about creating boundaries. What gets in, what gets out, who gets in and who gets out. And so a really cool illustration of that you can do at home with your friends. So he says, just pay attention for a few seconds or a minute to how often you swallow. And realize you're swallowing saliva every time that you do that. And none of us are troubled by that. We do it all day long, every day of our lives. Now take a minute and instead of swallowing, just spit your saliva into a Dixie cup and store it up just for 1 minute. It's just your own saliva, right? So nobody's put anything gross in it. It's just, it's what you would have been swallowing during that whole same period of time anyway. Now hold it in the cup and just drink it down. Well, you can't get anybody to do it. I don't want to do it. That's gross.
I just had a
That's
visceral
disgusting.
Reaction to that.
Yeah, because it's there's something about once it's crossed, once this thing has crossed a boundary, a thing that is, we know scientifically that saliva is just from me and it's all the stuff that I was going to swallow anyway. But suddenly it has become disgusting because it's crossed some kind of boundary that we've created. It's once it's gone out of my mouth, now it's an unclean thing and can't come back in.
Or if you drop food on the floor for more than 5 seconds,
suddenly
it's contaminated. Yeah.
And so he's got all these other little things like that. Like he talks about, he uses this term called negativity dominance. So the idea that the flow of cleanness or contamination always goes, the unclean always dominates the clean. So if an unclean thing comes in contact with a clean thing, it contaminates the clean thing, not vice versa. So you can have a swimming pool with, you know, I don't know how many thousands of gallons of clean water, chlorinated, clean, soapy, clean water. And if a little bit, if we find out somebody pees in the pool, suddenly, oh, we got to get out of here because it's the uncleanness takes over, even though we know in our heads it's about one little half cup of urine compared to 10,000 gallons of clean water, but the clean way doesn't clean up what's unclean. It always flows the other way. And then, and he's got a bunch of these, or like how things, once they're unclean, they stay unclean. So he'll take a glass of orange juice and drop a cockroach in it, and then say, would you like to drink this orange juice? Well, of course, nobody's going to drink the orange juice. But he'll take the cockroach out and then clean the orange juice, run it through various filters, and even cook it if you want to and clean it. Now will you drink it? Still, nobody wants to drink it because we think once something's become unclean, it can't be made clean again.
Hmm. So what are the implications for us in Christian community?
Well, so the implications for me as I thought about it were really all about relationship and our place in the world. And I live in a city, and so we're around all sorts of people. And our life in urban areas puts us in contact with all kinds of people who are often unfamiliar to us. We don't know much about them. We don't know much about their world. And sometimes with people who the only things we do know about them are the mythologies or the stories that we've heard as we've been growing up, and we've in various ways emotionally marked people as being unclean. In other words, they're somehow not right, somehow mm-hmm. different, and if I come in contact with them, somehow what's not right about them will rub off on me. And so you know, again, when you think about what direction that uncleanness goes, Jesus seemed to have this idea that by touching the unclean person, he could actually make them clean. But other people thought, well, you can't touch that person because they make you unclean. So Jesus reversed the vector, the flow of cleanness and uncleanness. We tend to think, and Beck makes the point that all of these, this disgust psychology is not really about information. It's about feeling. It's what we feel. So I don't really need a lot of information to tell me that people are people and that none of us are unclean. I'm not made unclean by contact with anybody, any kind of person. But I may still feel in my gut that you know, various categories of people might be so different than me that you know I'm made clean, unclean somehow just by contact with them.
So, can you think of anything that, like a specific context for you that this changed? your engagement with a group of people, perhaps, or the way you talked about engagement with other Christians?
I don't know that this particular reading this book has necessarily changed the way I think of things, but perhaps it helped me understand why I felt some of the things I did or some of the reluctance I did. And so in that sense, maybe helped me change. But, you know, the thing that I think about so much right now in our culture, we're having so much public discourse about homosexuality or various kinds of sexual minorities. So over the last 3 or 4 months, it's been about transgender people. And so we have, you know, if we take this work from Beck and think about how to apply it in that context, people, and particularly probably religiously conservative people, we have information about sexuality, but we also have generations of affective psychology, he would call it, the feelings that we have, the sort of deeply held but not often very reflective. We don't have a lot of informational categories about these things. We just know what we feel. And so right now in our culture, and maybe in other places around the world, where the world that we live in is in inviting us to question some of those feelings. And for a lot of religiously conservative people, that's really difficult. Regardless of what we think, we are having to wrestle with what we feel, and we've had this feeling that certain kinds of people are somehow unclean or impure. He talks about, for example, research where certain groups of people, heterosexual people, are unwilling to sleep in a bed that's been slept in by a gay person. Because now, and they can be told, you know, why that doesn't make any sense, but it just doesn't matter. It's what they feel inside. So there's a sense of uncleanness. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, right now we're wrestling with all the theological issues around all of that. What Beck forces us to wrestle with is that perhaps deeper than all of that is these deeply held feelings about categories that we've determined of certain people are unclean or somehow that our contact with them will in some way contaminate us.
And that look like looking at your saliva in a Dixie cup, like it's disturbing to look at those things deep within ourselves.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
It makes me think too of a friend of mine who has never yet been married, but she has 8 children. And she shared with me that in Christian community, people look at her like there's something wrong with her, you know?
Yes.
And she gets a very clear sense of being the other.
Yes.
We can unpack that in various ways, but it does make me think of it does not reflect the radical inclusion that, you know, theoretically we as Christians aspire to. And what is that deep within us? And within me, within all of us. We all have something like this, I think, a fear of the other. And that's something we talk about at Street Psalms in terms of peacemaking and in terms of identifying what we're in rivalry with.
Right.
Even when it's just ideas or parts of the shadow parts of ourselves.
The shadow parts of ourselves. And that really is probably where the fear comes through all of these things, and why, as we mentioned earlier, you know, that certain sorts of this psychology of disgust, they remind us too much of our own embodied being, and force us to face some difficult issues. I wanted to mention too that in this passage that we were reading, Jesus gives a list of things that come out of the person and how does he say that? Towards the end of this passage here in chapter 7, he says, there's nothing outside a person that by going in can defile, but the things that come out are what defile. And then he gives a list.
It's a long list,
too. It's a pretty long list, yeah. So he gives this long list, but one of the interesting things is that that Beck raises is that in the psychology of disgust, we tend to apply permanent categories almost exclusively to the sexual items that are in that list. If somebody envies, we don't apply a category that says they are envy. That is who they are now, and they can never be otherwise. That's just what the person is, or folly, or some of these ones. Maybe murder. I don't know. Maybe that's one that we would apply if a person is a murderer. Sometimes we'll say that. But the sexual words that are on that list tend to be things where we apply a permanent label to somebody. They are this thing. And once they, of course, and the most obvious example of that is once you've lost your virginity, that's a permanent, it's done, it's over. That category can never, you can't go back on that category. And Beck says we tend to do that. We tend to make that same application for all sorts of sexual issues, but we don't tend to make it for many other issues in our lives.
Well, thank you very much. Was there anything else that you wanted to tell us about?
Well, I would just say read the book. It's pretty interesting. You'll have fun reading the book.
I should make some brownies.
And you know, and one of the things he does say that make some poop-shaped brownies and have some orange juice with cockroaches in it or something.
That would be radical hospitality of an entirely different sort.
You know, the thing he says, maybe this, I think this is worth mentioning as we close. He says that that unless we can make some progress in understanding our own motivations around the psychology of disgust and the way we apply those things to questions of ultimate meaning, like religion, so that we say that certain people or certain types of people are somehow religiously impure or contaminated in some way, he says a lifestyle of hospitality becomes impossible. Because if we're concerned, if we're driven by fear of contamination, then the natural response is for us to put up lots of boundaries to protect ourselves. And hospitality is all about lowering those boundaries to welcome people into our lives. So to the degree we're driven by this sense of contamination, we're not going to be hospitable people.
Well, thank you very much again for your time, and God bless you and the work you do at Mile High Ministries.
Thanks, Steffi, and my greetings to all our friends in the Street Psalms community around the world.